Good afternoon. House Committee on Environment and Energy, Subcommittee on House Bill 2320. Tuesday, March 29th, 1983. Hearing Room 454, 1:30 a.m. Public hearing on House Bill 2320 requiring public utilities to purchase power from small power producers and cogenerators.
Call the Subcommittee on House Bill 2320 to order. Clerk will note that both members are present. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear testimony in response to the conceptual framework that has been put together for the new revised House Bill 2320. And the purpose of this meeting is to gather comments from the various people who are affected by the bill to try to find out whether there are ways to improve the bill or problems that people have with the bill in its present proposed form. The proposed form that we are dealing with is the draft engrossed bill, House Bill 2320, dated March 17, 1983, which I believe is the copy of the bill that everyone received last week. It was the one we distributed to people at that time. So if I could see the sign-up sheet. Jack Wood.
Mr. Chairman.
Have a seat. I don't know where the chairs are, but pull one up.
There's another
mic. We don't make people stand too much in order.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Jack Wood. Our company is Wood & Associates, Auburn, California. We are investors of small energy producing facilities. We have a facility in Lakeview, Lake County, Oregon, of which we have on site the capacity currently to produce 2 megawatts of electrical energy from low temperature geothermal fluids using a technique called binary cycle or organic Rankine cycle. And I think that the efforts at the state and your committee with regards to this bill are, and of course through Dave Philbrick through Department of Energy Oregon, is a very much needed undertaking. My only comments would be to the degree and some of the definitions. I think the scope is fine. I think the thrust is fine. I think that the intent of what you're trying to do is very commendable and I think quite useful. But as I go through some of the definitions, I find some difficulty in the definitions. We find in dealing with the various utilities, and in the Northwest we've dealt with several of them, and other areas we've also dealt with other utilities. Each one of the utilities has a different definition of what their interpretation of different items are. For example, avoided cost or per rate or incremental cost. Sometimes they're used synonymously, sometimes they're used separately, and always they're used, I think, to take advantage, perhaps, of the current economic conditions. I'd only suggest that as you go through your definitions, I would only suggest that you be as specific as you'd want to be, because I can assure you that after the fact, when this is passed, there's going to be a lot of exploratory operation within the framework of the words you'll choose on the definitions. For example, trying to define what avoided cost, the document that I have is the draft on your page 2. Let's see, this is engrossment from comments of ODO, March 25, 1983. I'm not sure if that's something.
No, that's the draft not everybody has.
This is something you're going to testify to anyway, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would prefer if your testimony could be related to the paper that's dated March 17th.
Okay.
In that those amendments that the Oregon Department of Energy has have not yet even been explained to the committee.
Okay, I understand.
And so I wouldn't want to be working off of them before we even know what they are.
I apologize. I was the first in the room. I was the first to sign my name, and I'm sure the order isn't
Oh, that's
right.
Fine.
The avoided cost, as you define it, means incremental cost. For example, I don't believe I'm speaking out of school, but Pacific Power and Light in some areas, and I don't mean to single out Pacific Power and Light, but in some areas, they have defined their incremental cost for power that they would be willing to talk as openly about without negotiation. It's somewhere between 13 mills and 20 mills. as differentiated from avoided cost. They're saying that that is their avoided cost is incremental, which is supposedly the amount of power that would be offset that isn't utilizing coal. That is the cost of their energy to produce the power. I'm only suggesting that we take a look at very finely the definition that you wish to implement. For example, we're in an area here in the Northwest that has abundant natural resources. Energy is one of them. Hydroelectric is one of the supreme resources. Currently, it's estimated there's several thousands of megawatts of surplus energy that are not being utilized by the various utilities. And Bonneville, for example, Bonneville Power is dumping water overboard. So when they talk about their cost right now, it has a detrimental effect in the development of the future of, say, alternates, or even I think will come home to roost to them when the different utilities who may go for different siting for additional capacity out a few years, when they start to look at their costs, where they have to actually amortize costs of capital, costs of legal, costs of permitting, cost of carry, everything that goes into what is the rate they must have to go before the commissioner to justify their capital expenses. For example, PG&E in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, is looking at over 111 mills just to be able to justify Diablo Canyon, if and when that ever comes on stream. I don't know what it would take to amortize whoops if it was ever allowed that the ratepayer would have the burden to pay off those indebtednesses. I don't know where that figure would lie, but I've heard some pretty high figures just to pay off where they are currently. My only suggestion is that your attempt, I think, should be thrust at parity, so the small rate, the small producer has equal ability under the statutes to look at what is avoided cost. Truly, what is it? Is it what their accountants say it is? Is it what I say it is? I think the definitions are very crucial, and I think that without that, there is going to be much the debate that the original PURPA Act intended. Trying to define, what did they mean? It's crucial. The economics to any type of project, whether it's a private stockholder company, is the economics of the development come down to what will the ratepayer pay. Then, of course, the Public Utility Commission in most states will then say and look out for the ratepayer's interest. What can we bear? What can the ratepayer bear? Comes back again, what can they bear? What does the law allow them to bear? And that's my real comment, is to make sure that the definitions are really thought out, because there is a wide difference of even the definition that you've used here, and I think even the one that Odo has come back to you with.
Representative Van Leeuwen.
Yes, a question. As you said that our thrust should be at parity as far as the avoided cost is concerned, what wording are you recommending that we would use?
Well, for example, there's a used car dealer in Southern California that appeared on the Johnny Carson show at night, and Johnny Carson asked why he deals in used cars. He says, I deal in money. My commodity is cars. He says, if I could make more money in oranges, I'd deal in oranges. I think the same thing we have to define here is, what are we dealing in? Here we're dealing in a utility service that in this case happens to be electrical energy in this regard. And it's a vast natural resource, and I think it's one of the few natural resources, if not the only natural resource that we have in the United States, that is dealt with on a regional level. For example, the folks in Topeka, Kansas, do not have the ability to have this vast hydro. We in Northern California, where I live, I pay 11 cents a kilowatt for my retail power through Pacific Gas and Electric, who then buys their power from Bonneville for half a cent a kilowatt, 5 mils per kilowatt on a surplus basis. All I'm saying is that you want to make sure that the definition would allow a true definition of, is it capital costs? Is it old costs? Is it buried sunk costs? Those are things that the utilities look at, as does the PUC and myself, when we're trying to define what do we need for a rate. I can tell you from our geothermal project what kind of rate we would need to economically come out. I then can say, well, what does it need? What do you need for a cogeneration, hydro? I have some statistics off the latest coal fire plant that was just commissioned in Nevada between Battle Mountain and Winnemucca, and what the the cost there, it ranges around 58 mils that is necessary to be able to just pay what the avoided cost or the cost of the power if you were to pay off for your monies, your capital costs, the carrying costs, and the long years of lead time to bring it on stream. I don't know what, for example, Diablo Canyon, I have statistics off that. I know the Boardman rate was pegged somewhere between 56 and 58 mils at one time. I guess it's pegged downward. I honestly don't know how it can go downward. I honestly don't, because when a company who has an oil well has oil reserves that only cost them $4 a barrel to bring in, I don't see too many of them coming forward and selling at $4 a barrel. I'm sure they're at the $29 or $30 or $34 a barrel. And that's, I think, one of the problems we have with the electrical energy. It's regionalized, and when in fact it's a national resource that we happen to be privileged in the Northwest to have a great abundance for. So that's why I think much of the nation will be looking to this type of legislation, seeing what Oregon's going to do. I'd only caution you to and recommend that you be very careful in the definitions.
Representative Van Leeuwen.
Another thing, you said that you knew how much in the geothermal that you were working with, how much you had to have. Are you privileged to tell us what it's going to take?
Yes, it's public knowledge. We've stated that before, Commissioner Lovdell, and that's approximately 70 mils, approximately 7 cents a kilowatt. And that's taking in a lot of things, that's taking out, I should say, a lot of mistakes we've made. I'll be the first to admit we've made some mistakes. And I don't know if it's mistakes or things that we could not have seen beforehand. And that isn't putting in all of the nice, neat things that we maybe want to put in on the first project. This is looking for down the stream. I could commit substantial resource, for example, energy to produce with our technology at that rate. I would sign a nice contract, long-term contract based on that type of rate. And I have statistics from other engineers that would say a coal fire would be substantially more, perhaps mainly because of the lead time. We can come on stream on these small wellhead generators in a very small period of time, permitting being the longest of the time. So we're well under a year in being able to bring these projects up to production, assuming we have the permits and the proper permits to do so. So one thing we'd ask that we can compete fairly in the rate structure, because that bears to whether we're going to come on in an R&D or are we going to go into production. I believe that at some point in time, we have to quit federal funding, state funding, local funding, participation, and we have to finally get into the production. Now, we've been told that, of course, by having a higher rate in this area than what is normally given, that we are, in fact, seeking subsidy. Well, I disagree with that because I get a lot of comments I can make, but by and large, if we have parity of the rate, in other words, what is the avoided cost if the utility, whether it's private or whether it's public, had in cost to bring power up today with today's dollars, today's overhead and so forth, what would the rate be? I'd say that we can be very competitive in most alternate energy, not all, but in most. But as it stands now, we cannot be because the rate structure is a little artificially swung towards the low side currently for economic conditions and also atmospheric conditions, rain.
Couple questions. One is you've said to be careful about definitions. I'm more than happy to be careful about definitions, but you're going to help me be careful about definitions and tell me what's wrong with the definitions.
I understand. I don't mean to be critical, and I apologize.
No, I'm not. I don't mean to be critical. It's a matter of you got to help me understand what's wrong with them, if there is something wrong with them.
I think it'd be rather, not simple, that's the wrong word, but I think it'd be at least obtainable to go through and define what is avoided and what is incremental. I think the words that you selected are good, but they also tend to be industry buzzwords that have many different meanings to many different people. I think that you should be commendable to zero in, and I'd be happy to give my input, I'm sure. And some views would be very biased, but I think in overall we'd be very objective about trying to define something we can work with, because if we come to an area, we find that that we have definition, we know where we're going, and we know what the constraints are, we can make a very simple or very quick decision on where we want to go. But right now, there are so many loose ends, there's so much conjecture as to the language. And I, for one, would be happy to assist in any way I can on this definition, although I'm not an attorney. So the legalese I can't supply you with. Concept, I'd be happy to help you in any way I can.
I guess my other question has to do with it's the way this bill is presently drafted. What's the utility down in Lakeview?
It is Pacific Power and Light.
Okay. As far as I know, for Pacific Power and Light, the federal regulations would supersede. I don't think that we're requiring anything here of private utilities. I may be wrong, but I don't think we're requiring anything of private utilities that the federal government isn't already requiring of them. I'm not sure. Dave, it seems to me that, is that statement correct or not?
Representative Bradbury, David Philbrick with the Oregon Department of Energy. In general, that is correct. However, this bill does require payment of full avoided costs and some things which are currently under federal litigation and provide some certainty there which would otherwise be absent. And it is possible that in the future the federal government could go a different direction, and this would still require in Oregon a climate which is somewhat consistent with.
So there is some dispute over the federal definitions, and we are coming up with a state definition which would apply to the utilities regardless of the outcome of the litigation.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also think that the utilities, in all fairness to Pacific Power and Light, we've had great support. We've had the usual negotiating opposite side of the table type of things, but we've come to resolve, and I think we have a good area, for example, in Lakeview. But it's been in spite of the regulations and in spite of the things that are currently on the books, not because of them. And that's the reason I'm kind of giving you this input. And I would think that the utilities, not being able to speak for them, but thinking that they likewise would like to have a definition that would not be subject to interpretation based on current economic conditions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I would ask if there are any further questions, but our other committee members stepped out for a moment.
Okay.
So thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you for your time.
Dave Philbrick from the Oregon Department of Energy.
Representative Bradbury. David Philbrick with the Oregon Department of Energy. Often one makes many mistakes, but you fairly realize that you make them so soon after having done them. We are extremely supportive of the concept that the committee put forward and feel that certainly one of our major concerns is that there be a vehicle put adopted and referred back to the full committee as soon as possible. We consequently feel that the bulk of the suggestions that we circulated earlier to people are in the nature of refinements which are probably not necessary at all. Would like to focus on two suggested changes, though, which I think are important. Looking at the proposed or the bill for consideration put out by the subcommittee, mm-hmm. and on page 3, starting in line 40, if I read the intent in terms of the concept that is put forward, in line 41, the guidance would be that the rate schedules should equal, not simply reflect, the forecasted incremental costs.
Wait, do that again, please.
In line 41, the third word in, currently says that the rate schedule should reflect the forecasted incremental costs. Would strongly urge you to change the word reflect to equal. The second change, which is in the same provisions there, is in line 42, where currently the Public Utility Commissioner is requiring a projection of costs for a much longer period of time than 20 years, and consequently would strongly urge the subcommittee to put in language in line 42 that would read over, after the word over, at least the next 20 years, so that 20 years was a minimum requirement as opposed to an absolute. The second set of changes which would like to encourage your consideration is on in section 10. It's on page 4 of the proposed bill. One of the things that the words currently do there, and looking particularly at line 6 where it says no less than, is that they have no longer really required the payment of at least the avoided cost. It says no less than the avoided cost, or it goes on, and in certain cases the base rate. Would recommending changing that so that it makes it clear that it is at least the avoided cost. And on that might refer to really we'll be advocating all of the changes which are proposed for section 10, which, if you want to refer to
Excuse me just a minute, Dave.
Right.
You sent me a copy. What you're proposing on here is already incorporated into this? Is that what you're doing?
Representative Van Leeuwen, that's correct, with the exception that I am really only at this point addressing about 3 of the changes there, which I think are the substantive changes. Beyond that, I think that we're, and what I'm recommending is, I think it was a mistake on my part to have proposed so many changes, unless the committee would have an interest to go back and address some of the other ones, I would be not encouraging your adoption of those today.
When do you think those issues would come before either the subcommittee or the full committee?
In general, I think that the issues are not substantive enough that they would need to be brought up. I think they are, in our opinion, they were improvements, but they were more working for a document which is probably better than what one could lead to expect. In other words, in many cases we were modifying definitions which have worked fine for the last, in some cases, 4 years. People have an understanding for what they mean. Our changes, I think, lead to definitions which might be better, but they certainly are not necessary.
Okay, let's go back to page 4 then, and I'll try to work from the model that we're all working from.
Okay. On page 4 with that model, this is one case, however, where all of the changes that we proposed for section 10 are ones which I would advocate that they be made. And consequently there, I think it is helpful to go to the draft of the bill with the changes, the proposed changes in growth.
Mr. Chairman, since the other people in the room have the March 17th draft in hand, let's work from that.
Okay.
Don't you think?
The first change would recommend then is eliminating the colon at the end of line 6,
mm-hmm.
and the subheading A on line 8, so that it would read that the rate that is no less, it would read that the electric utility shall offer a rate that is no less than the avoided cost of the utility. So that at a minimum have imposed a requirement that the rate offered shall be equal, at least equal to the avoided cost of that utility.
Okay.
But you are not inserting the language purchasing utility there.
Purchasing electric.
That is, I think, an amendment which is a clarifying amendment. And
but, okay, but that, for now you're not proposing that. Okay. I'll go back to the model I told you
okay.
to work with.
I would advocate then changing subsection B to 2. And one of the, and introducing language that says at the beginning there, in the place of in cases where A, insert the language purchases from a cogeneration or small power production facility by a non-regulated utility. Maybe the thing that would be helpful here is to deal it in concept as opposed to specific language.
Yeah. If you could just read it to us, you know, from your
okay.
proposal, that'd be fine.
In line 10, it would read, purchases from a cogeneration or small power production facility by a non-regulated utility that fails to make a good faith effort to transmit electricity from a cogeneration or small power production facility to another public utility or the Bonneville Power Administration shall be a rate that is the higher of the utility's avoided cost or a rate set by the public utility commissioner under what would then become subsection 3, currently identified as subsection 2. The main purpose for the change there is is to make a clear split between the requirement to pay at least the avoided cost, and then in the second one, in the case of a utility that fails to make a good faith effort to wheel, the requirement to pay the higher of the avoided cost or the rate set under subsection 3, currently 2. I think there are many different ways that could be drafted. The important distinction there is that the way it was previously proposed, it was a little unclear as to what the rate was that people were obligated to offer. And there was also it could have been read that a utility did not need to offer at least their avoided cost. And I think that, again, there are many different ways that could be drafted to get there. But I think that's a significant change that proposed.
Mr. Philbrick, I'm in looking at your new paragraph 3. It may be grammatical, but it seems to just sort of sit out there by itself. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't say what that subparagraph defines or anything. It just right out in there. This is the lowest cost stream of payments for purchases of power of similar characteristics, and da 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 da, and it doesn't define what that is. You see what I'm saying? I mean, you refer to it in subsection 2, but I'm not sure that subsection 3, it just stands out there by itself, and I'm not sure it's clear what it is.
Representative Bradbury, I guess I'm a little unclear with your question, in part because that's what the original, that's consistent with the original bill. Another way to have handled that would have been as originally proposed by PP&L, which defined in the definition section a term base rate and included it there, and then here you could just refer to shall pay at least the base rate. That approach does have difficulty in that it does use the term base rate or some other word, whereas this way you avoid using that term, which the subcommittee received some testimony from Hal Burkett was preferable.
I guess all I'm saying is that it may be totally grammatical. I don't have any problem with the concept. It seems to me that subsection 2 should probably say the public utility commissioner will establish a rate based on the lowest cost stream of payments. In other words, it's missing a verb as far as I can tell. A lot of people are nodding their heads behind you. So, that, I mean, it's not. I mean, it's not the concept that I have any problem with. It's the. It's just. I think it's sitting out there all by itself without a verb, telling you what it is or what it does. You do refer to it in the prior paragraph, but then you're not clear. You know, you're not saying that's an amendment we need to make, but it's not a big deal. Could you comment on what you? The amendments you're proposing in Section 10, what, in concept, what do they do?
Okay, let me, since I've started, Representative Bradbury, going down, if I could just complete the last
Oh, sure, year. I'm sorry.
Hadn't addressed what was previously Subsection 2, starting on line 16. The one change we would recommend making there is to introduce the words modify utilities in line 19. It discusses purchases filed by public utilities. Modify that to be utilities that own and operate their own generating facilities. The reason that we were proposing that was to get around the problem with entities like CP National. So it would be avoided.
Want to take their power to California, and that's certainly makes sense from an entrepreneurial standpoint. There are limitations on what can get on the intertie and when it can get on the intertie. Nonetheless, these issues are being addressed, certainly by Pacific, and I'm sure by other investor-owned utilities as well. There is a policy issue that perhaps the legislature sometime should consider. Do you want Oregon Renewables leaving the state? If so, when, for how long, under what circumstances, and do you ever want them back? I just throw that out on the table. I know when Pacific Power and Light felt it was in a deficit situation approximately 2 years ago, the company's policy in Wheeling, California is fairly strong. We want the power for our own ratepayers. It's Oregon Power. We want to keep it here. We have a little bit of service territory in Northern California. The same goes there. We wanted to keep it. Now that we have a surplus, those issues are being reexamined. But there are legal constraints also upon the availability of the intertie. I think what we're really addressing in this bill is basically intrastate Wheeling, not Wheeling within Oregon, as opposed to Oregon from Pacific Power and Light, Pacific Gas and Electric. I'm not going to read my comments on the draft bill. I do think that there are at least three major areas that ought to be addressed. I think the draft bill is going to take substantial additional work to make it fly if you decide you want to go along with it. I'm not sure that I think it's quite cumbersome, complex, sometimes internally inconsistent. I'm sure that if it's passed, we will spend significant amount of time figuring out what it does and how it does it. Having said that, the three major concerns I have with the bill are, one, perhaps a policy question or a policy dispute between Mr. Philbrick and myself that's been going on for approximately a month now. The question is, what is a qualifying facility? My position is, and it's partially just for ease of administration, because the company has six states in which we have to operate, to establish a definition for a qualifying facility that is right down the line exactly what Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says what a qualifying facility is. The reason for that is simple. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the sole entity empowered to determine under PURPA what is and what is not a qualifying facility. The legislation as proposed by Mr. Philbrick and the Department of Energy do use words somewhat similar to the words used in the federal legislation, but they encompass none of the qualifying criteria set forth in the federal regulations. To give an example, a cogeneration facility using sequential steam is not enough under federal rules. 5% of the processed steam in a, I believe it's a topping cycle unit, must be used for process purposes, and no greater than 95% of the steam be used for energy production, electric production, in order to qualify. If a qualifying facility in any year fails to meet those criteria, it loses its QF status. With its QF status goes all of its rights under PURPA, including not only the right to avoided cost prices, but exemptions from being a wholesale utility, sale for resale utility. The words that the Department of Energy proposes, as I said, parallel the federal regulations, but they say nothing about who in Oregon is to make the determination for Oregon on what is an Oregon qualifying facility if there is a divergence. Let me give you an example. We had negotiations, they're still ongoing, been going on for 2.5 years, with a entity in Sheridan, Wyoming, purchased an old 12-megawatt, sold for junk, coal-fired power plant. It used to be owned by Montana Dakota Utilities. The utility stripped the plant and sold off what it could, sold the rest of the plant for junk. The junk dealer bought the plant, found a coal supply, and then turned around and decided that they wanted to be a cogenerator. And the way they were going to do it was to put some equipment back in, start it up, and to qualify for cogeneration, they were going to put a greenhouse on the back end of the turbine in order to heat the air to grow tomatoes. It caused some eyebrows to go up in the company whether this is indeed what PURPA was after when the legislation was passed. And so we've been proceeding before FERC to gain a determination whether FERC says that this is or is not a qualifying facility. If it is, obviously we will proceed and purchase the power. If we had separate state legislation in Wyoming, we would have to have a state proceeding as well, because assumedly the state benefits would be there independently of the federal legislation. Unfortunately, there is no procedure set up in the DOE approach to tell what is or what is not a qualifying facility for Oregon purposes. What that means is that it's going to end up in court if we end up with a situation similar to the Acme Power Plant in Sheridan here in Oregon. Somebody's going to have to sue somebody else for a declaratory order, and whether or not the Legislative Assembly meant to include these types of concerns. Again, it goes back to the point that I believe that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has a staff that handles these matters routinely, what is and what is not a QF, should be the sole entity to make that determination. I know Mr. Philbrick will disagree again. I suppose that's just to be understood. I have a number of problems with some of the proposed language on interconnections, for example, that Mr. Philbrick proposed. I think that we want to be very careful on how we draft safety language if we are going to put any in this legislation. Again, there is legislation already under federal law and under state law which addresses safety of interconnections. But if the state legislature wants to insert itself, I think it should be very careful on defining who is to be protected. Specifically,
Yes. When you say interconnections, are you talking about wheeling or something else?
I'm talking about the point where the utility facility interconnects or meets the qualifying facility's generating equipment. Now, that can either be at the end of a line owned by a qualifying facility, as it is in the case of the Warm Springs plant that Pacific bought, or right at the plant itself. But where those two things meet, there is nothing. The safety concerns in the ODOE bill appear to run only to utility consumers. I think it's the utility linemen that are the ones that are quite concerned about interconnections. Other issues, resale of utility power, that's considered in the bill, basically the black box provision that says that a QF may not purchase power with the primary purpose of reselling the power. I can understand why that's there, but I don't think it's ever come up before. Nobody, I don't think, has ever tried to do that. Indeed, if one tried to do that, he would not be a producer. He would be a purchaser. I'm confused by that provision in any event. some of the words reliability of interconnected operations, how to ensure the reliability of interconnected operations. I'm not sure how any entity would draft a regulation to do that unless it's to create a laundry list of things that ought to be considered by the utility when it enters into these negotiations. The discussion of CP National and whether that's a problem or not, I really don't think it is a problem, and I don't think the definition has to be changed to accommodate CP National. CP National is not a Bonneville preference customer. Therefore, when CP National's contract with Idaho Power expires in 1985, they're going to have to get the power from somewhere else. The current thinking by some is that they will buy in a piece of one of the new Utah coal plants. It's by no means settled. In any event, CP National will be at that time in the same position that Pacific Power, Portland General, and Idaho Power are in. They will be basically required to go out and find a source of power. Now, they could conceivably go to the Bonneville 7F or new resources rate, which would be a melded rate including thermal power. Finally, I think the major problem that I had in the company in discussing this with company personnel was the tariff language, which now has been changed to read schedule. Defining a good faith effort to wheel as being basically promulgation of a wheeling tariff. There are legal problems with tariffs, and I indicated these previously to Mr. Filbert. My recollection is that any interstate commerce, be it whether the transaction is intrastate, in other words, between two in-state utilities or not, if the electric transmission grid is interconnected and spills over into interstate commerce, it is subject to the exclusive jurisdiction. Wheeling is subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Federal Power Commission, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. If that's the case, there's a legal question on what do you do with this tariff once you have it. It would seem to me if it could be promulgated, it would have to be filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. If that's the case, there's a similar provision in the order adopting rules issued by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under PURPA that says basically no utility is forced to wheel, and the Federal Power Act makes it quite clear that utilities are not common carriers for that statute. So the conclusion would be that the tariff approach is highly questionable legally. Even if it were not questionable legally, it can't work. It's impossible to draft a tariff or a schedule, whatever you want to call it, legal considerations aside, that will address the infinite number of possible arrangements with qualifying facilities. The price that one pays for wheeling is dependent upon a whole variety of factors. It's dependent upon the size of the line, whether it's 12 kV on the one hand or what, 500 kV on the other. Where the generation is in relation to the load, how near the substation is, what the existing limitations and capacities of the transmission lines are. One cannot merely say that for all generation that happens to come along anywhere in the system, it will be handled in such and so a manner. Each case will have to be dealt with separately. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that the company is opposed to a policy on transmission. The company is not. In fact, yesterday afternoon, the five vice presidents that constitute the PURPA 210 committee for Pacific took a crack at coming up with a draft generic transmission policy. But it, again, is a policy, not a tariff and not a schedule, basically saying that under these circumstances, Pacific will wheel power for qualifying facilities. I think that if you need a litmus test for good faith effort, it should be the adoption of a policy that allows wheeling under reasonable conditions, as opposed to the language of tariff or schedule. Again, a tariff is legally questionable, and a schedule is not workable. That's basically all I have.
Question in just a
Representative
minute.
Van Leeuwen.
Just a second.
Oh, incidentally, excuse me for interrupting, but I put in language that I think would describe the type of policy statement that I just referred to on wheeling, and it's on page 6, top of the page. A good faith effort to transmit electricity shall be demonstrated by pursuing with due diligence, and these are ODOE's words, the development and publication of a policy allowing wheeling on a cost-related basis. I think that's doable. But putting up a tariff that says two mils or 5 mils or 20 mils per kilowatt hour anywhere to anywhere is craziness. It just right. can't be done.
Representative Van Loon.
Okay. Mr. Nelson, you made several references to something being legally questionable in this proposal presented by ODOE, and someone told me today that either you or Mr. Philbrick, somebody had been talking to the Attorney General and putting some of these questions of legality past him. Was it you who'd been talking to the Attorney General on the bill, proposed bill?
I have asked for Representative Van Loon, David Philbrick, ODOE. I have asked the Attorney General to look at the bill and flag any problems that they saw.
Do you have any response back from that?
No, they have not had time.
I would add, I guess we'd like to know what the responses are to.
Certainly. We certainly want to know what the Attorney General has to say. Any further questions, Mr. Nelson? Thank you very much.
Not having had time to read the material.
I've been kind of wading through it as he presents it. I think I flagged your key points. Judith Miller and Libby Henry. I guess they want to be called at the same time.
We're very short. We are very short anyway.
Don't literally.
Microphone for each of you.
Turn right.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Loon. I'm representing Central Lincoln PUD, Judith Miller. I think you have all the information and cards from previous testimony. My utility was very delighted to receive your March 17th bill based upon the cover letter which described your conceptual framework on which you proceeded, the intent, the definitions, the purchase wheeling obligation, the purchase price, regulation reporting requirements, and the exemptions. As stated there, I think your intent certainly matches the intent and the operating procedures of my utility. The as far as the exact language of the bill and legal complications, and we'll leave that to other experts, you know, to get that ironed out. At this time, we have identified concerns and issues that we feel are unclear. They're very similar to what you've already heard. I don't think it's necessary to repeat all of those at this time.
We've heard from Mr. Nelson, or
Mr. Nelson. I think Dave Philbrick has also raised
some
points that are unclear. Certainly in all cases we would not like to see the clarity resolved in the direction that he has suggested. But they are issues that need to be resolved, and I do think that an Attorney General's comment on some of this would be very valuable to us. That was a recourse to which 2 years ago the House Environment Energy Committee a recourse they took, but there was never an opinion issued, so we really don't have any idea of whatever happened with that or what the thought was at that time. Pretty happy to answer any questions that I can.
I guess if you could identify, I don't know if it's possible, if you can identify in the
draft that we handed out at our last meeting, the March 17th draft, the areas where you think there is a need for clarification, I would appreciate that.
You want a list? You want it right now?
Sure, right now. You can do it.
Bill for an act. The elusive Section 2. Under Section 2, 2A. That appears to conflict with any number of other policies of the state and the responsibilities of the electric utility and should probably be withdrawn. Under Section 2, Sub 3B.
Okay, back you up a minute. Why does that, what's the problem with that? Promote the development of a diverse array of permanently sustainable energy resources using the private sector to the highest degree possible. What is that, why does that conflict?
It conflicts with the responsibilities that are put on utilities to develop resources at certain prices to meet needs of consumers. That could very well be in conflict by relying on other people to develop those resources, particularly if there's no assurance that those resources will continue operation or are not backed up in some way in case of facility failure.
Okay.
Section 2, Sub 3, Sub B, the settled and uniform institutional climate for cogeneration, small power
what
production.
What line are you on?
3435. Yeah, we could identify them by line. I'm sorry. That would make it much easier. I think that the legislature commissioned and funded the Alternate Energy Development Commission, which worked a long and tedious interim and came up with a very substantial report. In that report, they identified many, many problems that confront small power producers and co-generators that come under this umbrella of uniform institutional climate. The main concern in that was not the price of power paid by utilities. That was only one small little factor. And I don't think that this piece of legislation comes anywhere near addressing those issues. And perhaps that's, it's state, federal, and local bureaucracy were the significant problems at that time. And I don't know that most of those things have been changed at all. In my most recent review of it, they had not been addressed, and they're not even before you at this legislative session. Just this one issue is. Perhaps in that, what we really need is to help give a little bit of institutional stability and climate maybe to the utilities and the small power producers by inserting some reference that we can do this not in conflict with the Pacific Northwest Electric Power Planning and Conservation Act of 1980. That might give us a little bit more insurance that we're not having a conflict here and that it's clearly the policy of the state of Oregon that they don't intend to do that to us, to any of us.
Okay.
On page 2, section 6, starting at line 47, I'm not clear on who my chief engineer said, Judy, who does this mean that we have to transmit to, and what does this mean for the obligations of a middle person that has transmission facilities or lines? Where does the obligation string out? Are we just dealing with a generating facility in our service area that we just deal with on our lines and get it to a BPA substation so it can be transmitted through BPA facilities? Or are we talking about that if for some reason our system needs to be used to transmit the power to be an intermediary wheeling that we have some obligation in within this. We think it needs to be rewritten and clearly identified and be consistent with a PURPA. Not substantially consistent. I think we feel that...
Hold on a minute now. Can you come up with that wording so that we can see it?
Okay. Let me look at some of the other wording that's been submitted to.
Okay.
And maybe just say yes or no.
Okay.
The other issues he raised is that he feels that the balance of that appears to be consistent with PURPA and what we're doing now. We would like to double check that.
Where is this?
The balance of that section 6. Appears to intend to be consistent with PURPA.
Well, help me out now. The balance of it, you mean from line 8 on page 3 on
balance
down?
Balance of section 6 to line 22 that's blank.
That's okay.
Yes, right. It looks like it's okay. And it sounded just like it was also consistent with your statement on the front page on your understanding on your concept. One issue in Section 8, the issue that was raised was sub 4 on line 47, that might be an inappropriate place to include that submittal. It didn't seem to be drafted. That should be maybe its own section. In that, probably this is the best page to raise it on. On that page 3, lines 40 to 42, that the utility in publishing what its anticipated forecast incremental cost would expect to do that whenever its rates are adjusted and they adjust their own rates and on those time frames. For instance, we are looking at a new two rate increases in the next year, according to Bonneville, and that we would like, instead of an arbitrary time being fixed, to do any kind of publication, do it when we normally would otherwise.
Wait, I'm not following you there.
Publish rate schedules when we normally publish rate schedules instead of duplicating effort and time and cost and doing it at different times.
I think you're responding to Mr. Philbrook's proposed amendments rather than what's in here. I don't think it requires any timeline in here. So I think you're responding to Mr. Filler's proposed amendments, and what you're saying is that those the review of the forecasted incremental rate take place when you do your...
Yes, the question may have been also raised because of the current rules that we operate under and time frames we're already under. It may have been raised to me for that.
Well,
instance.
How would you feel about... requiring letting you do it whenever you want as long as you do it once every 2 years as opposed to making you do it every 2 years, you know, fixed if you have a revised rate schedule, you know, as long as it gets reviewed every 2 years.
Reviewed no less frequently than every 2 years if we didn't need to publish a new one.
Well,
for some reason there'd be
you need to adopt one every 2 years. Now, whether if it's the same as it was last time, you won't have to publish anything different, so it doesn't matter. If it is different, you will have to publish something different. Right? I mean, I don't see what difference it makes. As long as you review it and come up with your latest version of the avoided cost at least once every 2 years. When within that 2 years, I don't think matters to anybody. If you want to do it during your normal rate-making schedule, that's fine. I don't know. I mean, would that be all right as far as you can?
I think it would. I don't do the work, so I don't know. I think there are probably still some people at the utility who would assume someday we would be back in the good old days where we have nice steady rates for long periods of time and we don't have to do these things. Maybe it's a little bit of nostalgia.
Okay. Anything else?
I think not.
Okay. Can I ask you a question about the definition of good faith effort? Do you have problems with that? With the definition of good faith effort to wheel?
To me, that was not raised as a problem, as a problem at all, because we would always intend to, you know, our understanding of our working relationship with our consumers is that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. Representative Van Leeuwen.
Do you have a copy of what Tom Nelson just gave us? It has another proposal we've been given. We on the committee have been given too.
And I had an opportunity to read that while Mr. Nelson was testifying.
I have not had an opportunity to read it, but I would like to know, at least personally, sometime in the near future what your response to that is.
Yes, we'd very much like to have an opportunity to do that.
As compared to, you also have a copy of the
yes,
one that
I think,
Mr. Filker just
yes,
gave us.
Absolutely. I think Mr. Nelson raised very significant issues and addressed them far more comprehensively than did the quick review that I was able to get from my utility.
At least personally, Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate the different ones who are interested hear their response to those two proposals.
Two proposals.
Well, the two new ones that we've been given today.
Well, okay.
Which I have not had the